At Saint Edhar, Orlo had grown a little doughy, though he kept in decent shape by working in his vineyard and climbing the steps to the Starhenge. At Bly's Butte, according to Estimard's phototypes, he had lost some of that weight and gone shaggy-headed and grown the obligatory feral beard. But when I picked him up at the gates of Orathena and spun him around 5 times, his body felt solid, neither fat nor emaciated. And when I finally let him go, tears were making wet tracks down his tanned and clean-shaven cheeks. That was all I saw before my vision was blurred with tears, and then I had to break away and walk to and fro in the shade of the Great Wall to get my composure back. The discipline had taught me nothing of how to cope with such an event. Throwing my arms around a dead man. Perhaps it meant that I too was now dead to the mathic world and had moved on to a sort of afterlife. Cord, Yule, Ganel, and Saman had served as my pallbearers. It took a powerful effort of will to remember that they were still out there, wondering what was going on. There was a little fountain in the cloister. Orlo fetched me a ladle of water. We sat together in the shade of the clock tower as I drank. It tasted of sulfur. Where to begin? Oh, there's so much I would have said to you, Pa, if I could have when you were thrown back. So much I wanted to say to you in the weeks following, but it all flows back. Beg pardon? Those things flow back in time, and as they do, they change. Your mind changes them so that they no longer need talking about quite so much. Fine. Let's talk of what is fresh and interesting. All right. You're looking well. You aren't. Scars honorably earned, I hope? Not really. Learned a lot, though. But I did not really feel like telling him the story. We made idle chit-chat for a few minutes until we both realized how ridiculous it was, then got up and began to prowl around. A younger Fra, if that was the correct term for one who lived in a math that was not a math, brought me a bolt, which I traded for my secular clothes. Then Orlo led me away from the cloister along a broad path, beaten down by countless sandaled feet and barrow wheels, to the edge of a pit big enough to swallow the minster of Saint Edhar several times over. If we had built our monument by piling stone on stone, building up from the ground, they had built theirs by digging down, a shovel load at a time. The walls of the hole were too steep, the soil too loose to be stable. They had shored it up by using slabs of fused ash. A ramp spiraled down to the bottom. I started down it, but Orlo held me back. You'll notice there are no people down there. It gets hotter as you descend. We dig at night. If you insist on going for a hike, we'll ascend. And he gestured up the mountainside. I already knew from Saman's pictures and from yesterday's scouting trip that Orathena had 2 wall systems, an inner and an outer. They coincided along the road where the main gate stood. The huge 20-foot wall enclosed the cloister where the Avout lived and the hole in the ground where they delved. The outer wall was much lower, perhaps 6 feet high, so more symbolic than anything else. It reached thousands of feet up the mountainside, embracing a strip of ground that ran all the way to the volcano's caldera. It was clear from the pictures that mine works had been created up at the top, possibly to extract energy from the volcano's heat. So there I reckoned it would be hot, foul-smelling, and dangerous. But the territory in between, what Orlo and I walked through, had been transformed into an oasis by the labor of the lineage. Somehow they had found water and used it to raise vines, grain, and all manner of trees that yielded fruits and oils while casting dappled shade on the path up the mountain. The temperature dropped a little, the breeze freshened with every step. The effort of climbing kept me warm, but when we reached a suitable altitude to stop, enjoy the view, and nibble at the fruits we had pilfered along the way, my sweat dried instantly in the cool, dry wind off the sea, and I had to wrap myself up. We passed beyond the upper limit of Orathena's orchards and wandered through a belt of twisted, gnarled trees to a sloping meadow, dusted with what had looked, from a distance, like frost. But it was actually a carpet of tiny white wildflowers that somehow found a way to grow here. Colorful insects flew around, but there weren't enough of them to be obnoxious. They were kept in check, I guessed, by the birds who sang from perches in scrub trees and bursts of spiky vegetation. We sat on the exposed root of a tree that must have been planted the spring after the volcano had gone off. Orlo explained that these trees, which were no taller than I, were in fact the oldest living things on Arbre. Most of our conversation that afternoon consisted of such tour guide stuff. In a way, it was a great relief to chatter about birds and trees and how many cubic feet of earth had been removed from the dig and how many of the temple buildings had been excavated, rather than talking of such weighty affairs as the geometers, the convox, and the lineage. Later, we hiked down and supped at the refectory with the 100 or so Fras and Sewers who lived there. Their FAE, Fra Landasher, the third of the three who had interrogated me at the gate, formally bade me welcome and made a toast in my name. I drank more than my share of their wine, which was infinitely better than what Orlo made in his frost-bitten vineyard at St. Edhar, and slept it off in a private cell.